Hey Greg, I just want to tell you that I am thoroughly enjoying your show. Everything you produce on that show is perfect. Also wanted to tell you that when Art Bell left, I sent a letter to Dark Matter telling them that you should have been the replacement for Midnight in the Desert. Unfortunately for everyone, that didn't happen, I think. But I just became a Plus member, and I got your app, and I am eagerly awaiting your next show.
The planet's puppet masters almost surely have a plan. There's clearly maybe something there beyond the realm of man. And until you've thoroughly tested every last close trusted view, I find the more you think you know, the less you really do.
That's true, Dr. Zaius.
Where would we be without THC? We know they're lying to us, just don't know to what degree. Yeah, where would we be without THC? The highest side chat show, Greg Carwood Company.
All right, people, we know society has gotten even creepier in a post-9/11 world, and with no sign that a post-post-9/11 world is on its way, we find the dreaded surveillance state growing with every passing breath. Our old friendly neighborhood policemen looking more like an occupying high-tech military force, and our sleazy shadow state slinking out into the light as full-spectrum control becomes the new normal. Well, anyone who thinks that might be a little melodramatic might be singing a different tune after we hear the tale today's guest has to tell. His name is Robert Guffey, author of a new book, Camellio, A Strange But True Story of Invisible Spies, Heroin Addiction, and Homeland Security, that details the saga of a man who found himself accidentally wandering onto the radar of the great military intelligence beast in my old stomping grounds of Pacific Beach right here in San Diego. Robert is also the author of a previous book entitled Cryptoscatology, Conspiracy Theory as an Art Form, has risen through the ranks of Freemasonry, and has also written several pieces for Paranoia Magazine and other publications. It's an honor and a pleasure to have him here. Robert, my man, how the hell are you?
I'm fine. Thank you for having me on.
Yeah, man, it's awesome. I really did love Camellio, not only because I'm very familiar with the backdrop of the story, but also because of just how much it reveals about the surveillance state and the type of tech that they have at their disposal. I mean, assuming it's all true. And I'm sure that's kind of typically the first question you get, but the book is fascinating and really funny. And of course, people equate the writing to something like Hunter S. Thompson, which is a great compliment, but it makes one wonder how much poetic license was taken with it. So let me do the cliche thing and ask you, just how true is this true story?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Most of the people who read it, after they've read the entire book, I think they understand that it is, in fact, a true story. Mm-hmm. Though I think some people are skeptical because you are bombarded by lies so often, 24 hours a day, that when you see something that says a strange but true story, you immediately assume it must be the opposite. It must not be a true story because it says that it is. In this case, when you buy the can of peas in the supermarket and it says can of peas, you open it and generally there's peas inside. In this case, this is in fact a can of peas. It is exactly what it says it is. It's a strange but true story. It's everything in the book actually happened exactly the way I described it. The only thing that's fictional is that I changed the names of almost everyone except for those people who are public figures already, like Richard Schoengert, who we'll get to later on.
Yeah, that makes sense. So yeah, I guess let's dive into it. Tell us about this friend of yours, how you two guys are connected, and how this saga got started. It's pretty wild.
I first wrote a brief sort of outline of the entire story for 40 and Times back in 2013. It was called Strange Tales of Homeland Security. And from there, that's how our book found out about it. And then the book came after that was published around this time last year. And basically, it all goes back to July 12, 2003. And I know it was exactly that day because on July 12, 2003, that was the day I was initiated into the third degree of Freemasonry. And I mention that because it's important later on in the story. So after I went through the third degree, I called my friend Damien, who in the book I call him Dion, but he told me he didn't mind if I used his real name at this point. So his name's Damien, and I've known Damien since I was 16. In fact, I met him on my 16th birthday. So that's how long I've known him, and this is all occurring in 2003. So after the third degree occurred, I called him to tell him, you know, that I was still alive. And I left a message. He wasn't there. And then he never called back, which was unusual. He usually would get back to me within a day or two. But a whole week went by until he called me. And when he called me back, he told me this incredible story that a week before, his apartment in Pacific Beach was sort of a party house, pretty much a drug house. People were coming and going all the time. People would stay. People who he only knew vaguely would be staying on his couch. And one of these people was a guy named Lee. Supposedly his name was Lee. Later on, we were told his name was Doyle. So it's either Lee or Doyle. And this guy, unbeknownst to Damien, had recently gone AWOL from Camp Pendleton, which, as you know, is very close to Pacific Beach.
Mm-hmm.
Well, apparently when he went AWOL from Camp Pendleton, he took with him a 9mm Iraqi gun, 23 pairs of high-tech night vision goggles, a DOD laptop computer, and a truck. And so I've told people this, and sometimes they're like, whoa, how is that even possible? How could you steal all that stuff from a military base, 2 years after 9/11? I don't know. Well, that's just what happened, you know.
You can't carry all the goggles out.
Well, exactly. And also, I would remind people that if they are skeptical of that, if you go to YouTube and just punch in like a guy driving tank down San Diego, you'll see footage of a guy who stole an entire tank from an armory there in San Diego. And in fact, that ties into this story later on. There's a whole documentary about that called Cul-de-Sac. If you watch that documentary, which takes place in Pacific Beach, it's all about the guy who stole that tank. And when you watch that documentary, you realize that this guy was probably going through the same thing that Damien is going through in Camellia. But that's for later.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay. So Lee, he steals all the stuff from Camp Pendleton. And some of it he brings, some of the stolen equipment he brings into Damien's house. And Damien's at home one night. They're having this big party. Lee pulls out this stolen laptop and he opens it and turns it on, and immediately the DOD logo appears on the screen. The second Damien sees the DOD logo, he goes, whoa, wait a minute. Okay, get you and all your LoJack stuff. Just get the hell out of my apartment. Hmm. And the guy, Lee's like, no, don't worry about it. They can't track this stuff. Like on cue, you know, minutes later, there's a knock at the door. And Damien opens it. And there's a woman there who says her name is Special Agent Lita Johnson, which is the name I used in the book. That's not her real name. She represented herself as a special agent for the NCIS, which, by the way, this is before the NCIS TV series. I think this was the first time I'd ever even heard of the NCIS.
Yeah.
And this woman was there with two other officious-looking gentlemen behind her. And she tells Damien that they need to search his apartment. Damien, whose father was a narcotics cop, by the way, knew full well what his rights were. And he said, well, you come back with a warrant and then you can search the place. And she said, we'll be right back. He closes the door. He turns to everyone at the party and he says, everyone grab your stuff, meaning your drugs, and go out the back door. They all like throw their drugs down on the floor and then go out the back door. Immediately, within minutes, the police come. The police and the NCIS come at the same time. They're all kind of, it was very strange. They arrived at the same time, yet they didn't seem to be working together. They were kind of Keystone Cop-like, bumping into each other and kind of arguing with each other.
Hmm.
And the NCIS, what they were mostly interested in, they wanted to know where these goggles were. Well, apparently some of them were in the apartment. Lee had brought them in with him. Some of them were not. And they, even though there were drugs all over the place, they didn't care about that. They were obsessed with these night vision goggles. So they arrest Lee / Doyle and Damien and bring them both downtown to the jail in San Diego. And they grill the two of them for a whole week. You know, they separate them. They're grilling Damien. They think Damien's involved in some effort to sell this equipment to Al-Qaeda.
Hmm.
They want to know, like, you know, who Mr. Big is, who he's working for, who his contacts are. Damien's trying to say, listen, I barely knew this guy. And what do you mean you barely knew him? He's living in your house. You must have known him. And he didn't want to cooperate. Damien's been in and out of prison. He's been homeless. He was on the same cell block as Mike Tyson in Maryland. He was on the same cell block as the Menendez brothers and OJ in LA. They always put Damien into the cell block with the celebrities because Damien's dad's a narcotics cop, so he's considered to be at risk from the other inmates. So they always put him in the same cell block with these other celebrity inmates. And so he's been in and out of jail his whole life. You know, the code is you don't snitch. There were other people involved that he didn't want to pull into this whole situation. So his whole attitude was, I'm not giving you any information. And anyway, he had no information to give them. They wanted him to like serve as a witness for them against this Lee kid. And Damien's like, I can't serve as a witness because I don't know anything. You know, everything I've told you, which takes about 2 minutes, is what I know. Mm-hmm. Well, they gave him the Abu Ghraib treatment for about a week. And then finally at the end, they let him go. And at that point he goes home and he calls me and tells me this whole story. And both of us thought, well, obviously that's the end of it. They realized, you know, cooler heads prevailed and they realized that Damien doesn't really know anything, and that this whole Kafka-esque nightmare is over. Well, it was just beginning at that point, in fact, because then a couple of days later, Damien calls me back to tell me that there are these people following him around. And at first, it sounded really outlandish because he was telling me that it wasn't just one person or two people following him around. Like 14 people, 14 military-looking jarheads are following him down Garnet Avenue. He goes into a 7-Eleven, and these guys just follow him in, and then a whole parade of people and then follow him out. He goes into the Mexican restaurant down the street. They all come in and like sit down at different tables. And at first I thought, wow, he must be suffering from meth-induced paranoia. Obviously, he's gone over the deep end. This sounds really weird. But then things started to happen that seemed to indicate that, well, no, maybe he wasn't crazy. He was telling me that, you know, there were these cars following him around. They were parked outside of his apartment all day and night. They would shine halogen lights through his bedroom windows just to fuck with him. And I said, well, if all that's going on, I go out, write down license plate numbers of all the cars that you think are following you and like take photographs of those license plates and those cars. So he does that, and he sends me a list of the license plates and the photographs, and I even include the list of license plates in the book. Mm-hmm. And I happen to have a friend who worked for the DMV in Seattle, Washington. So I sent him the list of license plates, and I said, run a check on them. And he did, and all of them came back as officially non-existent. And the only reason that would be is if they were government vehicles.
Right.
Because I know the cars existed. I saw the photographs, you know, and even if he was randomly making up numbers, even though that's not possible, if he were just randomly making up numbers, you'd think he would just, you know, accidentally hit on a vehicle that existed. So obviously the only reason these vehicles would not be in the system is if someone did not want them in the system. Mm-hmm. So that was the first indication that, okay, well, maybe this is not just paranoia. Well, the harassment like stepped up from there where they were doing just bizarre things. It was clearly not an attempt to be surreptitious and follow him around. The intent was for him to see them and for him to know that he was being followed and to finally slowly drive him crazy, essentially.
Right.
And they started bombarding him with hallucinations, with kind of, he would look out the window of his living room. And outside the window would be this alien landscape. I describe it in the book as the kind of like Boris Vallejo painting with three moons in the sky, just this crazy, surreal landscape out the window. Then he'd open the door and it would look like it was supposed to look. Close the door, look out the window, and there's the weird alien landscape again. One night he was laying in the bed and they projected a silhouette of a hand with a gun that would tilt down and then the gun would point at his head. At one point, his leather jacket was lying on the floor, and this kind of amorphous blob of protoplasmic energy crawled across the floor, crawled into the leather jacket, and then the leather jacket crawled across the floor. There were things like people would come over, a friend of his came over and said he had told me that he felt that the apartment was getting smaller and larger, that he'd come into his apartment and that it seemed to be much, much larger on the inside than it used to be, kind of like Doctor Who's TARDIS. And after he mentioned that, a friend of his comes over who hadn't been there in a while, and the friend goes, "Is your apartment growing?" So it wasn't just him. Other people were seeing this as well. Then it got to the point where he was reporting to me that there were people in his apartment interacting with him who he could not see. So they would come, they'd push him over, they'd talk to him. At one point he was in the bathroom and brushing his teeth, and he moved the mirrored medicine cabinet. And as he was moving the mirror on the medicine cabinet, he could see behind him these, quote, invisible people in the mirror, but only when he was looking in the mirror. And when he said that, Damien doesn't have any sort of scientific background, but to me, it kind of made sense if you had some sort of perhaps light-bending technology or something that you would be able to see it in the mirror, but not in the mirror.
Yeah.
And that was another indication to me that maybe all this was in fact occurring exactly as he was describing it. And I should probably note that also surrounding his apartment, like within a mile of his apartment, were various corporations that specialized in creating exotic weapons and technology, like ATC, American Technology Corporation, and most importantly, SAIC, Science Applications International Corporation. SAIC was just within pretty much walking distance of his apartment. Though both of those corporations have since moved, SAIC has split into two different corporations, one of which has kept the name SAIC, and the other branch calls itself Leidos, I believe, Leidos, and they moved their headquarters to Virginia. But at the time, all these corporations were based just a stone's throw away from Damien's apartment. And so all this stuff, the stuff with the invisible people and the harassment, all that stuff continued to the point where I remember I was talking to him on the phone one night. And Damien doesn't spook easily, and yet he was cracking up at this point because they were actually bombarding him with, as I was talking to him, bullets came in through the window, but they weren't visible. They were like acoustic bullets, bullets made of sound, which AT, American Technology Corporation, was in fact working on exactly that around the same time period. And I put those articles in the book. Acoustic bullets come through the wall and just starts blowing up all these tchotchkes that Damien has on a shelf. They just start things start exploding, like a window explodes. All the stuff starts exploding around him, like almost like a poltergeist activity. But this wasn't, there was no poltergeist. There was nothing supernatural about this. And I heard that, while I was on the phone with him. Also, they would do things where they would just suddenly cut off all the ambient noise in the apartment. Which at first sounds like, well, big deal, but that actually has a kind of Chinese water torture kind of quality to it. When suddenly just everything goes dead silent and you can't hear anything outside the window, they would do things like this. At one point, there was an attic that ran the length of the apartment building, and you could enter through the attic through a little door, trap door, up in the ceiling above his bed. And he wondered if maybe they were up there, if someone was up there with technology or something bombarding him. So he went up there and he actually heard this as if like a giant tiger was running at him through the darkness, and he immediately bailed and left the attic, of course. He never went back up there again. And neighbors moved. New neighbors came in who were decidedly unfriendly, which is a pattern. I later learned is a pattern. And meanwhile, while all this is happening, this woman, Lita Johnson, the special agent from NCIS, who was the main person grilling him in the jail, she would show up on his doorstep. All the people who were parked outside would go away, and then suddenly she would appear, and she would knock on his door and say, "Hi, how are you doing? Have you changed your mind? Have you decided to cooperate now?" And then he would say no. And then she gave him her card and said, well, if you change your mind, call the number on the card. And then she and her two goons would leave. And the second they left, all the cars would come back and the harassment would start up all over again, even worse than before. And she was regularly like contacting him, you know, letting him know where this is coming from. And so since she gave him her card that had her phone number on it, I asked Damien to give me the phone number. And at one point I actually called her and had a conversation with her, and the transcript of that conversation is also in the book. And she seemed very flustered and surprised that anyone was calling her about Damien. And I said, my friend claims that your agency is surveilling him and following him. Is that true? And she just would give me these kind of convoluted Clinton-esque kind of CYA language, like, no one in my agency is currently following your friend. You know, just very precise language like that.
Right. I actually liked that part a lot, because I guess it was at this point that the harassment had got him to the point where he wanted to leave town. And so you called her just to make sure that that was kind of a kosher thing, that he wasn't breaking any laws. And you point blank asked her, like, hey, can he leave the state or can he leave town? And she would be really coy and say, well, it's not illegal for him to leave, but it could complicate things and I wouldn't recommend it. Like, what does that mean, lady?
Yeah, exactly. What does that mean? And she sort of implied that he was crazy. But meanwhile, none of her answers, you know, jived with Damien being crazy, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was around this time it got really bad. So, all this begins like around, as I said, it was around July 2003. And it gets more and more intense until early 2004, where Damien had lost weight. He was urinating blood at times. He had a metallic taste in his mouth, which I later learned is a symptom of electromagnetic radiation poisoning, basically. And he happened to run into this beachcomber guy down at the beach who had this van that he was trying to sell. And so, if I remember correctly, it was like $500, $600 or something that the guy wanted for the van, and Damien didn't have any money. So without even telling him, I wired him Western Union $500. And as you probably know, if you go pick up money at Western Union, you need a password. The other person needs to give you a password. So I called him to tell him, hey, the van, it's yours. You know, I just sent you the money. And I was going to give him the password at that moment. He said, no, don't give it to me yet. He was concerned that if anyone was listening, they would go and pick up the money before he could go get it.
Yeah.
So he goes, I'll call you back after I'm ready to go, and I've got all my stuff ready. I'll call you back and ask for the password. Well, so a couple hours later, he calls back, and right at the second I was about to give him the password, the phone cuts out. Then I call him back. I'm about to give him the password. The phone cuts out again. Call him back. I'm about to give him the password. Phone cuts out again. Just over and over and over again, that pattern. And then I suddenly remembered something. When you make a collect call, there's a brief period there when the operator says he's going to ask the other person if they'll accept the charges. During that brief moment, the other person can hear what you're saying.
Yep.
So I placed a collect call to Damien, and as the operator was about to ask him, will you accept the charges, I just yelled out this hint that only he would understand what it meant. And he immediately understood. He knew what the password was, and then the phone cut out like a second later. So he was able to go to Western Union, pull out the money. He gave it to the beachcomber guy. So now he's got this van, and the van was a sight to behold, because later on I actually rode in the van. It was this black, like, Punisher mobile van, like right out of the old Punisher comic books from the 1980s. Just this black van, and it barely worked. It sounded like a jet engine taking off. Exhaust would come up into the passenger seat while you were sitting in it. You couldn't open the door. If you were sitting in the passenger seat, you couldn't open the door to get out. He had to get out and open it on the other side.
Nice.
He put all these bumper stickers on them, like quotes from Thomas Jefferson and words that said things like, you know, gaslit and loving it. And so it was not in any way a surveillance vehicle. But he put all his stuff into the van and he just decides to leave, because that's what a lot of people do in this situation. They think if they leave the city, it'll stop.
Yeah.
It turns out that's not the case. I mean, since the publication of Camellia, I've been contacted by well-paid attorneys, you know, previously living a high lifestyle in Minnesota, who are now living on the beach in Santa Monica because they can't afford anything else because they lost everything because the surveillance has basically destroyed their life. And
damn,
they moved and that didn't help. I know a guy moved to Australia. It didn't stop. A guy moved from Florida to Thailand. It didn't stop. So just leaving doesn't help. But at the time, we didn't know that. So he gets into the van and he just takes off. He leaves a note on his door saying, "I'm heading west," which of course would be the Pacific Ocean. And he immediately went towards Texas. And he calls me from a payphone on the side of the road, in the middle of nowhere, to tell me that there's this little drone following him around. Now, keep in mind, 2003, you know, I mean, drones, it's not like today where everyone's talking about drones and people are shooting drones out of the sky and drones are getting in the way of commercial airplanes. I mean, no one was really talking about drones. But here he is telling me that there's this little UFO-like drone following him around. He drives all the way to Texas. From Texas, he goes to Minnesota, where he has a son who at that point was, you know, I don't know, 11 or something, 10. And he went all the way to Minnesota. And at one point, he's in a bathroom, goes into a bathroom in Minnesota, and he's there washing his hands, and a guy comes in who he's never seen before. And the guy comes up to the sink next to him, and as the other guy's washing his hands, he turns to Damien and says, "Listen, if you just give the stuff back, all of this will end." and the guy, he didn't say it in a way like threatening. It was more like pleading. It was like, "I'm tired of following you around. Will you please just give the stuff up?" And then another guy comes in a second later, grabs the first guy and drags him out as if he broke protocol or something. Because this was only one of two times where anyone had actually broken the script and admitted that he was being followed. Because the whole point of it is to make the other person think that they're crazy, that they're imagining all of this. So it wouldn't help to actually admit that you're following the person. The only other time happened prior to this, when Damien was in his kitchen, and there were these two guys just outside, just being really obnoxious. So Damien's making lunch and he puts peanut butter into a bowl and like flour and baking soda and Jell-O, the cayenne pepper. He like mixes it with cream. He mixes it all together into this goo. And then he just runs out and he tosses it over the fence and it hits these two jarhead looking guys. Now they're covered in all this goo and they run off towards the Vons parking lot that's next door. Flash forward a little bit later, he actually met with Lita Johnson, hoping to make a deal with her so that they would stop harassing him. That didn't go well. But there was a point where Damien said, "Listen, I'm willing to do anything to get this to end." He goes, "I don't want to have any more food fights with the feds." And Lita Johnson and her superior officer, her boss, was there at this meeting at a bagel shop on Garnet Avenue. She laughed and said, "Oh, yes, that made us all laugh." that was the only other moment when anyone actually admitted that this was actually happening, you know. So, okay, back to the bathroom in Minnesota. This spooks him, obviously, when the guy says, "Just give the stuff back, this will all end." He leaves the bathroom, gets back into the van, keeps driving. He ends up in Winona, Kansas. And if you go look up Winona, Kansas on the internet, you'll see that literally like 104 people live in Winona, Kansas. It's really small. And on the way there, his van breaks down the side of the road at night, and these two good old boys with thick Southern accents pick him up. And I know this because I spoke to them on the phone. They pick him up off the side of the road, and he tells them the whole story, everything I just told you. And these two guys are skeptical. They think that I don't know, Damien's yanking their chain or something. So they actually, they call me. Damien gives them my phone number and name and says, "Well, call this guy and ask him. He's a professor. He'll vouch for me." So out of the blue, I just get this phone call and I hear this guy with a thick Southern accent going, you Guffey? You Professor Guffey? I go, yeah. He goes, you know a guy named Damien? And I'm in my mind, I'm wondering what has he gotten into now? and the guy's like, he told us this crazy story, and we want to know if it's true. So I tell him, yeah, absolutely, all that's true. He's being followed. There were invisible people, et cetera, drones following him around. As I'm talking to him, the guy freaks out because they see the actual drone outside their house. It's descending right outside their house, and their mind gets blown. And I asked them if they would please put gas in Damien's van and help him get back on the road. And they actually did that. Once they saw this UFO looking George Adamski flying saucer outside their house, they were willing to help him. So they put gas in his van. He ends up in Winona, Kansas. For some reason, when he gets to Winona, Kansas, all the surveillance stuff stops. Now, I don't know if that's because they willingly just pulled back on it, or if it's because the town was so small that maybe you just can't get away with it. I mean, if a stranger came into a town with 100 people in it, and then 17 Marines are following him, you would think that would stand out. Yeah. It's hard to get away with that. It seems to me that you can only get away with this in a major population center like San Diego or Austin or Los Angeles, where, you know, a lot of people don't even know their own neighbors, you know. So he ends up in Winona, Kansas. He kind of is able to breathe for a little bit. And while he is sort of recuperating for all of the insanity, he starts going around the internet trying to find anything that looks like the invisibility or cloaking technology that he saw being deployed in his apartment. He came across a Japanese professor who had created this invisibility cloak and had garnered some media attention because of this. But that didn't really look like what he had seen. It was a little clunky. Then he goes through other things, and suddenly he comes across this website called Chameleo.net, which is run by this guy named Richard Chongert, who's a scientist who has a top secret clearance, or did until just recently. He recently retired last year. And Richard Chongert has this private operation going that he calls Project Chameleo. It's not a government project, something he was developing on his own time with a colleague, Dr. Lev Berger, who's an eminent physicist, well respected. And Richard Chongert had all this description of the technology and how it worked. He had spoken at various military conferences about this, and all that was also on the website. Damien contacts me and says, look at this guy's website, because this kind of looks like what I think I experienced. So I go, I look at the website, and I'm surprised, and synchronicity plays a huge role in this whole story. I'm surprised to see that Richard Chongert says that he's a 33rd degree Freemason with the Long Beach Scottish Rite. And I am a 32nd degree Freemason at the Long Beach Scottish Rite. So we're lodge brothers, me and this guy. Like, I must have met him at some point, you know, and didn't know it. So I contact him and I say, I'd like to interview you about this technology, this Project Chameleo. And I say, you know, I'm a part of the lodge of the Long Beach Scottish Rite, and I've done various other interviews, and I've written articles, et cetera. So he writes me back and says, okay, yeah, that sounds good. You know, let's meet at the lodge this Saturday. There's a ritual going on anyway, Saturday morning. We'll meet up there, and then we'll go have lunch. So I brought Damien with me. Damien came all the way down, and I meet Richard Chongert that morning, Saturday morning, and I immediately recognize him, and I realize I have seen him before, that we've never been formally introduced. I had seen him performing the rituals on stage many times. And I bring him out of the lodge after everything's over, and I introduce him to Damien. And this is my friend Damien. We all three go out to lunch. And then I bring Richard back to my office on campus, and I interviewed him for about 2.5 hours. And the transcript of that conversation is in the book. Now, when I sat down to talk to him, I wasn't certain if anything he was going to say was going to tie into Damien's experiences. That it could very well be that it would have nothing to do with it at all. But before we can even broach the subject, everything Richard says just lines up perfectly with everything that has occurred to Damien at this point.
Right.
He mentions that, just all on his own, he mentions that he'd gotten a visit from SAIC, from San Diego, 10 years earlier, inquiring about his technology, Project Chameleo. He'd gotten a visit from the Navy. The Navy had come down to his laboratory in Hemet, the laboratory that's owned by his partner, Dr. Lev Berger, which I've been to that same laboratory. It's in the middle of nowhere in Hemet.
Right. My parents actually moved to Hemet not long ago, and you're right. It is pretty rural, we'll say.
Exactly. And so the Navy went all the way down there to the lab to see what they were doing, and they seemed very interested. And the SAIC also seemed very interested, and yet they would never get back to him afterward. Now, Richard thought they were contacting him because they wanted to collaborate with him to fund the project. But no, in fact, Richard said, even before I asked Damien to tell him his story, he said it was almost like they were picking his brain. And in fact, he even said, sometimes I wonder if they stole it from me. And he had already at that point hired an attorney to look into exactly that. And so these guys were more like vacuum cleaners, you know, the intelligence parlance for someone who comes in, picks your brain, sucks up all the information like a vacuum cleaner, and then just leaves.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm asking him questions about the technology. Could you make someone think they're going crazy with this technology? Can you, instead of just making someone camouflaged or invisible, could you also create hallucinations? Could you make something appear to be something else? And he says, oh, absolutely. Yes, that's in the patent. The psychological warfare aspects of the technology are in the patent. And I say, well, okay, let's say you want to bombard Fidel Castro with hallucinations. You could do that with this technology? Oh, yeah. You can make a tree look like an octopus or whatever. I said, could you make a room seem larger on the inside than it is on the outside? Absolutely, you could do that.
Mm-hmm.
and just on and on and on, point by point. And then finally, after about an hour and a half, I said, well, Damien has a very interesting story he wants to tell you. And at first, Richard seemed a little wary, like, what are they springing on me, you know? And so Damien, he starts telling his story. And at first, Richard seems a little skeptical until the point where Damien gets to the point where he mentions being able to see the guy in the mirror, but not visually. And Richard leans forward and he goes, yes, he goes, that's because they were camouflaging the suit, but not the reflection in the mirror. And then Damien mentions that sometimes he would be able to see them visually, but only like in the form of these little dots in the air, like people with migraine headaches sometimes see auras in the air.
Right.
And Damien sometimes suffers from migraines. And he said, that's kind of what it looked like. It was kind of like these like little dots in the air. And Richard leans forward and goes, that's exactly what it looks like when the technology is not working correctly. And at that point, Richard understood that Damien was telling him something that he had actually seen, that this lined up. I mean, that's like a detail that no one would know.
Mm-hmm.
Except for someone who had actually worked with the technology. And it was Richard's theory. He's the one who broached, if you read the transcript, you see he's the one who brings this up. Because it seems to me like they were using you as a test subject. I remember at the time telling a friend of mine that all this was happening, and she said, why wouldn't they just test this technology on Camp Pendleton? Why go outside the military base? Well, it makes sense. You want to test it in a real world scenario.
Right.
Just the other day, I heard on the news that they were doing from Camp Pendleton, the bomb squad from Camp Pendleton came to LAX to do all these real world tests of basically like role playing scenarios of defusing a bomb at the airport. And they try to do it in a scenario that is as much like the real world scenario as possible. So in this case, it's perfect. You want to see if someone can see your invisibility technology, and at what point does the technology break down? When can he see you? And you want to test that out in a situation that's real and live and random before you put people in harm's way in the Middle East. You know, you want to know if that technology is going to break down in some junkie's apartment in Pacific Beach before it breaks down in, you know, in Osama bin Laden's bunker.
That's
in
true.
The Middle East. So I think that and that's what Richard thought, that obviously this guy, they seem to pick on people who are on the edges, on the fringes of society, drug addicts, homeless people, people who already have a history of maybe mental problems. That way, if they start talking about it, who's going to believe them? And it just so happens that in this case, Damien, they happen to pick a guy whose best friend from high school not only already had written about conspiracies in Paranoia magazine, but I was also a 32nd degree Freemason who was in the same lodge as the guy from whom they stole the technology. Now, no one could predict that. I mean, that's a level of synchronicity that's beyond comprehension.
Right.
So after we talked to Richard, Damien, we went through a period where I was not in touch with Damien for a while, maybe like over a year. He moved up to Humboldt, where his mom was living. She lives in an area called the Lost Coast, and he moved there with his mom, and for a while, everything seemed to dip off. He was staying in San Francisco for a while, and he noticed that the harassment would start only when, like, there was a big Occupy protest or something like that in the neighborhood, which happened often because it was San Francisco. So on those days, he learned to stay indoors, but if he went outside, suddenly there they were again, you know, like 19 people following him. For some reason, it would sync up with these protests, almost as if, well, there's this protest going on, you know, who's ever is on the watch list, you know, they need to be surveilled at this, mm-hmm. at this particular point in time. So he moves from San Francisco to Humboldt. He's staying with his mom. It starts picking up again. He starts feeling the metallic taste in his mouth again, that type of thing. The second he moved into that area, because of course, as we know, in Humboldt, there's a lot of marijuana farmers there.
Mm-hmm.
And the second he moved in, suddenly the drones started appearing again, and all the local marijuana farmers thought that they were surveilling their marijuana farms. So they'd rush out with their rifles and start shooting at these things in the air. But they all told Damien these things didn't appear until, you know, you moved in. So he stays there for a while, and then eventually he got into his van and he moved elsewhere. Recently spoke to him not long ago, and he said that it had started up again big time. So it seems to go in these waves where they'll pull back a bit, and I don't know if that's part of the whole plan, you know, to make you think that everything's going to go back to normal, and then they suddenly yank the rug out from under you again. It seems as if it never ends, essentially. Once you're on the list, and then you really have to think, which is why I think Camellia is an important book, because anyone who reads it and understands the importance of it, you have to kind of, as Theodore Sturgeon said, the science fiction writer Theodore Sturgeon, his advice to writers was ask the next question. Particularly science fiction writers, always ask the next question. But not just writers, anyone should do that. Always ask the next question. Like, what's the next question beyond the scenario? When we see something like what happened in Brussels, where you had two brothers who were on the American terrorist watch list, but somehow they were able to initiate this massive attack, one has to stop and say, okay, wait a minute, this Damien was doing nothing. It was a pretty harmless person, except for the fact that he was involved in drugs, but that wasn't harming anyone.
Mm-hmm.
He can't go to the bathroom without 9 jarheads following him in, and yet these two brothers who were on the American watch list could initiate a major terrorist attack? How is that possible unless they want them to actually pull off the attack?
Right.
See, that's the next question that one has to ask after you read Camellia. The only conclusion you can come to is that's not possible. The only way that someone like the San Bernardino attacks, where the woman was actually on Facebook announcing the fact of what she was going to do and saying that she announcing her alliance with various terrorist organizations on Facebook, and yet they were able to pull off these attacks in San Bernardino, but Damien can't walk down the street and buy a hamburger.
Right.
Those two things can't exist in the same reality.
And I also noticed on your blog you had written about that Uber driver case. I mean, of course, some people are just crazy, which is where the line really gets blurred, but even he said that the app made him feel like a puppet and drove him to shoot the people he picked up.
Oh, absolutely. He said when I logged onto the Uber app, it started making me feel like a puppet. And now you have to say to yourself, oh, well, yes, it's possible that he's crazy, but except for the fact that all these things seem to line up with these mass shooters, mm-hmm. with the guy, the naval yard shooter who carved in the letters ELF into his gun, which some people thought meant, you know, like an elf, like, you know, like, but no, ELF, it stands for, you know, electromagnetic frequencies. And he had Dalton, the guy, the Kalamazoo shooter, said that the horned cow head of a devil would appear on his phone screen and give him an assignment. And he said that, according to a police report, Jason Dalton told authorities, quote, it feels like it is coming from the phone itself. And he didn't know how to describe that. He also described something, quote, like an artificial presence, unquote, the report said. And things like that go way back. Mm-hmm. I was being interviewed by Tessa Dick. Tessa Dick was she's the widow of Philip K. Dick,
right.
The science fiction writer who wrote Ballast and A Scanner Darkly and Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? And she, it was a fascinating interview because at some point she was ostensibly interviewing me about Camellia, but at a certain point I began interviewing her, mm-hmm. you know, and she's telling me about, you know, in the 70s, when she and Phil Dick were living in Orange County, it was the same scenario. These neighbors moved in with weird equipment. Suddenly, voices were coming at them through the radio, saying insulting things to Phil Dick. The radio would play, even though it wasn't plugged into the wall, all the seemingly sort of paranormal phenomena. If you read Phil Dick's book, Valis, boy, it sure sounds like he was a targeted individual.
Yeah.
And that book is worth reading for that reason. Also, his book, A Scanner Darkly, which is all about the drug scene in Southern California,
right.
in the 70s, you know, ostensibly it's set in the future. Ostensibly it's a science fiction novel, but it's clearly about his own experiences in Southern California in the 70s. And that book, which is probably like one of the best drug novels ever written, in that book, the narc, the main character, Bob Arctor, has this suit that it's a skin tight suit that basically camouflages your features. And I remember telling Tessa Dick, and she was amused by this, that at one point Damien said to me, I wish that Phil Dick had written happier novels, because it's clear that they're just reading a bunch of Phil Dick books and manifesting them all in three dimensions in reality. And so maybe if he'd written utopian novels, we'd be all living like a happier life. And yeah, so, you know, I was friends with Walter Boart, who wrote Operation Mind Control, which was, it's like the classic text. It was the first book to really write about the American MK Ultra mind control projects,
right.
in any deep sort of way. And he published that book in 78, I believe. Richard Condon, who wrote The Manchurian Candidate, wrote the introduction to that book. And Walter, if you read Operation Mind Control, you can see the origins of all this. And fortunately, because I was already friends with Walter, I was sort of in a position to be receptive to the story that Damien was telling me.
Right.
I think most people would have assumed that he was just going crazy. Even with my background in that, that was my initial assumption. You know?
Yeah, but you had a little bit of context, which definitely helped.
Absolutely. And, you know, some people say that these specific techniques, which I wasn't familiar with at all, the whole gang stalking phenomenon, despite the fact that I written articles for Paranoia Magazine and Steam Shovel Press and these sort of conspiracy zines that grew out of the American landscape in the early 90s. Despite that, I had never really heard of gang stalking. I had heard of mind control. I'd heard of, you know, the control of Candy Jones and all that kind of scenario.
Yeah, gang stalking. Oh, sorry. I was going to say gang stalking is a weird one, and it's one of the more recent terms that I've heard in this whole realm, and I haven't heard very many cases of it detailed, but one thing I thought was interesting in this case was Damien mentions a few times where he like throws his drink at one of these guys following him or does some other over-the-top behavior, and these people don't react because, again, it seems like they have strict orders not to engage the target.
Yes, it's you can actually have fun with this if you can break past the barrier, which at some point Damien did, of thinking that you're going crazy. You can actually have fun with this. But at one point, one of these guys was following him all the way around town. So Damien went into a 7-Eleven and got a big, like, 40-ounce blue raspberry Slurpee. And as he's walking across the street and the guy's following, Damien suddenly turned around, threw the Slurpee in his face, and called the guy a faggot. Now, normally, some military-looking dude in San Diego would not react kindly to A, having a blue raspberry slushie thrown in his face, and B, being called a faggot.
No.
The guy did nothing. Just stared at him with blue raspberry dripping down his face. And that's not explainable.
No, it's very awkward.
And at one point, one of these guys was in the supermarket, following him around the supermarket. So Damien managed to get behind him, and he grabbed one of those tinfoil, those you know, big aluminum tinfoil things, and just started sticking it in his ass. In the supermarket checkout line, and the guy is just staying there, just sort of growling to himself. Because he's been told not to interact with him.
Yeah, man, I love those elements, and it is such a real wild story. But I wanted to revisit Lee a little bit, because of course he's the catalyst for all this. He goes AWOL from Camp Pendleton, steals this laptop that's got the DOD logo on it, these night vision goggles, a pistol off a dead Iraqi general in this truck. He opens the laptop. You mentioned that he pulls up a couple files marked top secret and above top secret and shows some blueprints for vehicles that Damien didn't recognize, but, you know, probably didn't get too much information there. But, I mean, this guy, does anything happen? Does this guy ever show up again after they're initially arrested and then given that 6-day Abu Ghraib kind of interrogation? Does Lee ever come back into the picture? Do you know what happened to him?
I have absolutely no idea what happened to him. I'd love to know. Someone asked me this question when I was on a show, Darkness Radio, which airs out of Minneapolis. And the guy asked me, well, wait a minute, you know, shouldn't you be able to easily figure out, you know, how many people go AWOL from Camp Pendleton named Lee or Doyle? You know, could you figure that out? You can't, if they don't want you to know it, you can't find it out. I mean,
right.
Basically, you as Richard Schoengert says, you know, because he hired a lawyer to try to prove, to get the paper trail that his technology had been stolen. Problem is, what you really need is someone on the inside to say, you need this exact serial number. And then when you have that exact serial number, then you can use the FOIA information request and get information back. Otherwise, it's like you're just shooting blind. And if they don't want you to have something, they'll make up some reason why they can't release it to you, or they'll give it to you and it's entirely black. I mean, I had a situation where I read about this in the first book, Cryptoschatology. The last chapter in that book is called Collaborating with the Dead, and it's also a weird story. This happened before the whole Damien thing. I went to high school with a guy whose name was, swear to God, his name was Steve Seaman. And Steve Seaman was sort of like the valedictorian, big man on campus. He went on to, he graduated at the top of his class, all-American boy, you know?
Right.
And he was a senior when I was a freshman. So we didn't know each other, but we had a mutual friend. And Steve Seaman ended up working for the FBI in the mid-90s. And within a couple of years, he rises through the ranks, and he's in charge of the white-collar crime detail, the FBI in L.A., and he was the head of the investigation into the DNC fundraising scandal that was going on in the middle of the Clinton administration.
Wow.
I open up the newspaper one day on December 1st, 1997, and I see that Steve Seaman has shot himself in the head at the beach at Dockweiler in Manhattan Beach. Inexplicably, he went to the beach. He left a note for his roommate, who was an LAPD officer, told him he had been arrested the night before for carjacking, and then he grabs his gun, goes to, in the middle of this investigating the Clinton administration, he goes down to the beach and blows his brains out in front of cops.
That's not the first time people investigating the Clintons have suddenly wanted to kill themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. So Steve Seaman, I start looking into it. This is this is very bizarre, you know. So I initiated a FOIA request. I got all his files from the autopsy. I did an experiment. I wrote two letters to the FBI, FOIA request for Steve Seaman's entire file. Anything they had on Steve Seaman, day he was born to the day he died, is what I asked for. And I wrote two letters. One letter I wrote under my own name, and that letter is completely nuts. It's like a crazy man wrote it. And it's actually hilarious. If you go read the book and read the letter, I mean, it's insane. And then I wrote a second letter that was completely sane, very reasonable, and hit all the points that you're supposed to hit when you're requesting a file. It was very specific and very professional. And that letter I gave to my friend, who was friends with Steve Seaman. And he sent that letter under his name. And then I sent the other letter under my name. And we waited like maybe, 6 weeks in between. The letter that my friend sent, the very reasonable, very scholarly, journalistic, rational letter, he gets a letter back saying, we have no information on Steve Seaman. Zero files. The one that was the nut letter that I wrote, I got 272 pages. So, in other words, they chose to send the nutcase all the files.
Right.
And they sent the rational guy nothing. They told the rational guy that they had no information to give.
That's funny.
So that's an example of how they operate. So, no, the question is, no, I don't know what happened to Lee Doyle. I would love to know. And every time I do one of these interviews, I'm hoping that someone... Maybe Lee himself comes forward to say what happened to him.
Right.
I don't know.
If he can, you know.
If he, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, he might be in Guantanamo or some other black site. You know, they found that one in Chicago not long ago. They discovered that this building that they thought was just out hidden in plain sight, actually inside was a black site for the local police to take people that they couldn't take to jail. I'm sure those are in every major city. Lee's probably hanging out in one of those still.
Right, all right, yeah. Or he's hanging out with Steve Seaman and Vince Foster.
Right, sleeping with the fishes. Oh, man. The last real thing I wanted to ask you here, you know, you mentioned synchronicity played a big role in all this coming together, and the book and story does reveal a lot. Obviously, the military intelligence organizations didn't sign off on this one. Did you have any problems getting this book and story out?
I had a lot of problems getting the book and the story out. First of all, I published a small segment of the interview with Schoenger. I sent that to a number of magazines who I thought would have been interested in it, like Wired and magazines like that. And my entire experience of sending out short stories and articles, you always get a response, even if it's just a form letter. No, mm-hmm. Thank you, whatever. But this, no response, like nothing. as if they never received it.
Ah.
Same thing with the article, Strange Tales of Homeland Security, and then same thing with Camellio, the book. And I think it was just because a lot of the people who did respond to Camellio in the manuscript format when I would send it out, I think some of them thought it was a joke. That I was just pulling their leg or something, you know.
Yeah.
To me, it almost like there are stories about when the Impressionists first started painting in that particular style, a lot of people would go to the gallery and they weren't able to see any images in the painting. They just thought it was just random blobs of paint, and only a few people were able to actually see what was supposed to be seen in the Impressionist paintings. It's almost like that. There's like a certain segment of the population that just, they can't even see it. They don't want to see it.
Yeah.
And they don't want to have anything to do with it.
Man. Well, awesome. I love the book, and it's been great talking to you. Before I let you go, is there anything else you wanted to tell the people, maybe about the book, where to get it, or your own website, or anything else you got going on beyond this new book?
The website is cryptoscatology.com. CryptoScatology, cryptoscatology.com. And then you can buy Camellio either from Amazon, or you can buy it directly from OR Books. And I think you get a discount if you order it through OR Books. It's in both in print form, and you can get the ebook, which is cheaper. It's also on, it's an audio. You can get it as an audio book as well.
Nice.
So that's orbooks.com. If you just go there and click on the catalog, you'll see the book there, Camellio.
Very cool. Well, thanks again, man. Amazing story. Hopefully that this doesn't put me on the list, and maybe we can do it again when Hollywood Haunts the World comes out. But until then, take care, man.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. You got it. There it is, guys. Boom. I love that story, and I can understand how at first it might come off as paranoid ramblings from a heroin addict, but it isn't. There's just too many other pieces. Robert called Lita himself, the license plates, and all of Richard's confirmations. It's crazy to think about the level of technology, black budget projects, the shadow state, or a breakaway civilization, whatever you want to call them, the technology they might have, but I found it super interesting, and I loved the further implications of the stuff that we talked about in the Plus show, where we get into even Bob Lazar, Philip Corso, and how this and some of the local corporations in San Diego might tie into the Millabs thing. You know, a lot of people say Millabs, but I say Millabs because this is supposed to be short for military abductions, so I'm sticking with Millabs, but it really is interesting and eerie to know that I am so close to some of this stuff. But Camellio is a great book. The transcripts of several conversations are in it. Those are some of my favorite parts. But Robert does write with a great sense of humor, too. So it's an easy and fun read, while also getting a peek into electronic harassment, gang stalking, and some of this tech they might be using. I thought it made for a great show. So do think about signing up for THC Plus if you agree. Also, I mean, end of the month. There was a Money Bomb winner. Just haven't heard back from him yet. But I'd say this has been a strong month for THC. We started with Joshua Cutchin and the Trojan Feast episode, talking about the food and drink offerings of aliens, fairies, and Sasquatch. I thought that was a fun show. David Rodriguez and the education conspiracy and the history of forced schooling. Very near and dear to my heart. Also, we brought Gordon White, the maestro of modern chaos magic, back to talk more about starships, understanding non-human logic, and entity influence throughout history and what that looks like. Really pushed my understanding of magic and entity communication a bit further. And last week, Dr. Richard Allen Miller, Magic, Military Intelligence, and Higher Consciousness. That guy is quite a trip, but he says some really interesting things. And he was around at a time that I really wish I had a better window into. So to talk to someone of that generation alone is fun to me. But all good shows all have an extra second hour that you might not have heard if you don't have Plus. Consider it. Help support the show and further entertain yourself. And I would say learn stuff too, right? We learn stuff. I think so. So just go over to thehiresidechatsplus.com to do that. And then you can also get the Plus shows on the iPhone app if you're using that. I think I'm going to work on another clip that I can just put at the end of the free show that goes over everything that I should be taking the time to say every show, because I still get the same questions about Plus and things like who sings these closing songs and how can I get them. They are artists I've hired to cover songs, and I've switched some of the lyrics myself. They are all free to download on the Plus site, and Plus members do get full access to the archives. Another question I get. Not all of them are in the RSS feed. For really old shows, you do need to get the MP3s from the website or the app directly, but yes, you can get all that too. There's getting to be so much information to give, and I just am not consistent enough about giving it. So I'm going to work on just a nice little clip to put at the end of the show. Bada bing, bada boom. But if you do have any questions about getting Plus or confusion about how it might work, you can go to thehiresidechatsplus.com and click on the Frequently Asked Questions and Help link from the menu bar. Gives you a lot of good information, or email the hiresidechatsteam@gmail.com, and I'm sure we can clarify whatever it might be that needs clarification. Also, remember that the Great Conspiracies sale of 2016 is going on right now. Shirts are less than $12, and I'm trying to clear out what I have here at the house, so I will personally mail you those shirts if you get the ones that are on sale until they're gone. Conspiracies.net. Big thanks again to Robert Guffey and all this month's awesome guests. Damien, if you're out there, I wish you luck, buddy. Stay safe. You've had a hell of a ride, I will say that. And that's probably it for me. From the seedy Shadow States Coastal Paradise, your move, Invisible Midgets. Your fucking move.
Oh no, you see, The world isn't random, it's attached to puppet strings. Control over everything. The 9 to 5 is trying to steal ya. Now don't that job seem silly? Hello, can you hear me? Or should I play back recordings from some spy agency? Wish we were younger and free. I'll be thankful when it's all exposed, the vast conspiracy. There's such a difference between us and the damned Rothschilds. It's no secret, and that the best is plus, it's doubling your time.